Welcome to the Kitchen Counter Podcast, episode 188, Talking Food with Mark Bittman. Hey everybody, thank you so much for downloading and listening to this episode of the show. I'm Roger, your host, and this is the podcast that's all about home cooking, getting in the kitchen, learning new things, having fun, being inspired. And really, I can't think of a better person to have on the show to talk about home cooking than Mr. Mark Bittman, who's going to be joining me in a few minutes. But first things first, I have to say that today's episode is brought to you by Tillamook Ice Cream. Actually, they don't even know I'm saying that. And no, they're not even giving me anything to say that. But as I record this, I'm sitting, like, I swear, directly under whatever crazy heat dome is happening over the Pacific Northwest. On Saturday, I don't know, it got to 100 and something here in Salem, here in the Willamette Valley. Sunday, smashed an all-time record, 113. Look, I know some of you are thinking 113 degrees, big deal, but the all-time high record in Salem ever was 105, and I don't know how long ago that was. But so we pretty much pushed that one right over the cliff. And this is in June. Like, we get hot, and sometimes 100-degree weather's not unheard of. We'll occasionally get that in the summer, a couple days maybe. But that's like late July, August kind of weather, not pre-4th of July weather. Pretty crazy. Anyway, Monday, who knows? But Tillamook Ice Cream, enough of that, will get you through just about anything. So thank you, Tillamook. That's all I've got to say. Oh, Utterly Chocolate is the flavor to beat for my money. So check that out. By the way, I have to remind you that the Kitchen Counter Podcast is a proud member of the Nitty Grits Podcast Network, out of the Southern Food and Beverage Museum down there in New Orleans. Southern Food .org to check that out and the other great shows on the network. One other bit of housekeeping, the show notes for this episode will be over at kitchencounterpodcast.com/188. There I shall put all the links to the stuff Mark and I talk about, most notably, of course, his podcast and some other things he's got going on, like the Bittman Project and things like that. Where I should say, he has this great, great article. We talk a little bit about it on the episode called Why Knife Skills Are BS. And I had not read the article before I talked to him, but afterwards he told me he had written it and I went and read it, and it's fantastic. It really sums up how I feel about home cooking these days. I think it was fantastic. So I put links to that in the show notes too. Go check that out. If you want to get a hold of me directly, then feedback@kitchencounterpodcast is the best way to do that via email. I'm over on Twitter at TKC Podcast, Facebook, all that stuff. You know, I'm not deeply into social media and on there a lot, but you can message me at those places and I'll definitely get back to you. All right, let's get on to Mark. Now, Mark Bittman, you probably know the name. You might be very familiar with Mark Bittman, but if the name rings a bell, it's probably because he's written a lot of books about food and cooking, over 30, I think, by last count. And actually, in my kitchen, I have a copy of How to Cook Everything by Mark Bittman, which is one of his, I would say, cornerstone books. If you're a home cook and you only have a limited amount of room for cookbooks, that should definitely be one that makes your short list to check out. But he's also written books about veganism, grilling. I mean, you name it, he's written books about it. You might also know Mark from his time, 30 or so years over at the New York Times as a food writer, columnist, magazine food feature writer, things like that. He's been on TV shows. He's been around, and he is definitely a national treasure and resource when it comes to home cooking. So it was a really, really my pleasure to get to talk to Mark about his podcast, Food with Mark Bittman, And while he was here, we touched on a few other topics. We talked about vegetables, how to get more vegetables on the grill this time of year, and what vegetables he thinks are overlooked and unsung. We talked a little bit about High in the Hog and a few other things. So definitely check this out when you're done here. Head over to kitchencounterpodcast.com/188. Get the show notes for Food with Mark Bittman and give that a listen. All right. Without further ado, here is my conversation with Mark Bittman. So, Mark, thanks so much for being on the show today. I'm super excited to talk with you.
Pleasure to be here, Roger. Thank you for having me.
I'm a longtime fan. I'm sure nobody ever tells you that. I've got a copy of How to Cook Everything. I don't know what edition in the kitchen, but it's in a place of pride next to a few other indispensable cookbooks I keep close at hand.
Two people told me they were my biggest fans the other night, so I told them they had to duke it out to see who was right. But yeah, it happens. It's nice.
Yeah, I imagine it is. But you've written a lot. You've and correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the majority of your work in food media has been writing.
Yeah, by far.
You've written several books. You were a columnist, obviously, a well-known, you know, column, The Minimalist, among other things, for many, many years. So you know your way around pen and paper, and you know your way around food and food issues in home cooking and cooking in the kitchen. But I understand now podcasting might be a new avenue for you. You've got a new show out called Food with Mark Bittman, which is really great. I think you're, I don't know, four or five episodes in now, maybe more.
Five today, yep.
Yeah, five today. I find your show very refreshing. It's just no nonsense, and I really quite enjoy it. I really like how you describe recipes. I mean, you have a very natural way of talking through when you include those in the show. But tell me a little bit about the show itself.
Well, thank you. I've done recipes in every form. And when we were talking about the podcast, we decided let's include recipes, but how are we going to do them? Because everybody's tried to talk people through cooking, and it's no one's cracked that code. I'm not sure we've cracked that code either, but I did a book once called Kitchen Express, which was based on a series of New York Times pieces that were what we called prose-cipes, that is, recipes written in prose, two-sentence recipes, something like that. And those are popular among people who know how to cook. If you don't know how to cook, it's really challenging. But we're trying that kind of thing on the podcast. Here's how you make a avocado and tomato salad in 5 minutes. Here's how you make a plantain omelet. Here's how you, whatever. But just fast stuff that you can talk people through. And as long as they have some fluency in cooking, it works. It's not, here's how you roast a chicken if you've never roasted a chicken before. I don't think anyone's really cracked that orally, which is probably one of the reasons cookbooks are still popular.
Yeah, absolutely. I've even tried doing like live cook through audio only, and it's tough.
It's really hard.
It's tough. People pick up on weird things when you do it that way. And it's like, I remember I had one guy write me and he's like, what are you scraping the vegetables off the cutting board into the pan with? I'm like, what do you mean? You know, and right. Like, that's what you took away. I shouldn't be using my knife. Okay. Anyway, I've listened to several of your episodes, and your first one was with Nigella Lawson. I actually listened to that one twice because I just found it, you know, so down to earth. And I have long lamented that I think the majority of food media really gets it wrong for the average home cook. I think they give unrealistic expectations of the process of cooking. They give unrealistic expectations of what the food should look like when it comes out of the other side of that process. And then you have like this whole generation of home cooks who maybe haven't been taught by their parents or people in their family or something, or haven't been educated in cooking, thinking they need to cook like somebody on Chopped, right? They need these crazy knife skills and the food needs to look amazing. It's like, that's not what real cooking looks like.
That's the disservice that food television in particular has done to cooking. And it's been that way for forever. It's made it so that food is either a competition or you have to be, you have to feel inadequate. I mean, either way, it makes cooking challenging or appear to be challenging. And it does give people unrealistic expectations. I always say it's like watching tennis and thinking, oh, well, I can't play like Roger Federer, so I'm never going to even try. And yet people play tennis and people do cook, even though they don't cook like, pick your favorite TV personality, or they don't cook like the people on Chops, or they don't cook like Top Chef people. But that's not what cooking's about. I know you know this. TV has really, as I said, done a disservice, and audio hasn't been, if anything, it's worse. So, you know, the question is, how do we encourage people to cook and take away the fear factor? Because really, people have been cooking for 10,000 years or longer, and anyone who's ever decided that they want to do it has been able to do it.
Yeah, that's a good point. And you're just going back to that conversation you had with Nigella. I mean, you made a joke, and I'd love to see it when you do turn it out, but you said you might even write a column on, you know, how knife skills just are not important.
Really. I did write it.
I haven't seen it.
It's okay. On the Bittman Project. You'll have a look. Yeah. Because I just thought there was that, and then there was a podcast. A guy interviewed me for a podcast, and I said, you know, I really have to write that knife skills are bullshit column, because I've been threatening to write it for 10 years or more. And I just, there's something about admitting you're not good at something that everybody thinks you're good at. But I'm not good at using a knife. I'm, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, I'm a 5, I suppose, but I'm sure not an 8 or a 9. So, and it doesn't matter. I mean, it just doesn't matter. So, yeah, we don't need to have that conversation because it's been had. But yeah, there are a lot of things about cooking that are misconceptions. A lot of things need debunking, I think.
Yeah, and I think part and parcel of that too is, I think a lot of people, and I was like that too for a long time, I'd be embarrassed if like somebody walked up to me in the grocery store and looked in my cart and, you know, afraid they'd see like a box of dried pasta, and it's like, you don't make your own. It's like, well, you know, you just have to get over that, right? There's this elitism that comes along with a lot of the food media that I think also does a disservice to the home cook. When the majority of home cooks just need to get good, nutritious food on the table for their family in a timely manner, right? Without spending a weekend, you know, making everything from scratch.
I mean, that's what it's all about. And to the extent that you can do that, that, you know, that is food mecca, really.
So today's episode that you just dropped on June 21st as we record this is with Stephen Satterfield, who I'm excited to listen to this one, because I'm about halfway through the High on the Hog documentary on Netflix, mm-hmm. but I've read Jessica Harris's book, just finished that actually, sort of fortuitously, and I'm loving it. And I'm interested just to get a little bit of your thoughts around this idea of, well, I think you said in the episode notes, again, I haven't listened to it yet, but, you know, assigning identity to food is difficult in general. I'm probably paraphrasing that incorrectly, but I'm just curious to know, you know, where do you see like the intersection of that kind of finding the food origins and cultural identity when it comes to food in your average everyday home cook? I mean, does a home cook care? Or, you know, what can a home cook do with this, you know, to make their cooking journey more enriching?
I don't know. Mean, we were very lucky to get Steve, and I didn't even know about High on the Hog when we booked him. I'm a big fan of Whetstone, and we have personal connections. So I was really excited that we had asked him to join the podcast, and he said yes. And then I binge watched High on the Hog. I think it's 4 hours long. I watched it in 4 hours, kind of like that. Look, I think one of the reasons I'm doing the Bittman Project and doing the podcast is because I want to encourage home cooks to see the link between the food that they cook and the food that they eat and where that stuff comes from. So you may not be interested in race or think you're not interested in race, but that's there in the food you're eating. You may not be interested in other people of the world or other countries or whatever, but that's where your culinary influences are coming from. You may not be interested in how food is produced, but it is as important as anything else about it, maybe more important than other things about it. So I see these projects, both the newsletter and the podcast, as an attempt to be, as an attempt to be educational, as an attempt to say, I've thought about these things long and hard for many, many years. And the links between cooking and every other aspect of food are there to be seen, and they're important. And not everybody's going to acknowledge them. I had to fight to get the New York Times to let me write about serious issues around food that weren't cooking issues. But those issues are there, and it's all linked together. Food is, we all eat. It's an obvious statement, but food is as important as anything, and where it comes from and what its origins are and what its influences are, those are all things to take into account when you talk about and think about food. It doesn't mean you need to, like, every time you cook, say a blessing or give thanks. I mean, you can, but I think awareness of where food comes from, where our traditions come from, what all of that is about is helpful in many areas, in many ways.
Now, you mentioned the Bittman Project, which is not the podcast, but it's also another fairly recent media endeavor of yours, right? I think just this year, right?
Yeah, we launched in February, although we had a newsletter that we were publishing through Medium for a couple of years before. So really, in a way, and it was called Heated. It wasn't called the Bit. We've had a hell of a, everybody who tries to name anything knows that it's just the minefield right now. But so we've had a bunch of names, which is why the Bittman Project is a great name, because no one can contest that.
Right.
But we've been doing the newsletter thing for 2 or 3 years and now the podcast. And obviously the idea is to be independent, not beholden to any publisher, be our own publishers, do what we want. Obviously, it's risky from a financial perspective, from a can we be successful perspective, and the fact that maybe I'm late to both of these games. You know, there are many established podcasts, although fewer around food than people, certainly fewer around food than around football, for example. Right. And newsletters, too. It's a crowded field. But we, you know, I have a team of 3 or 4, and we are having fun, and we are doing what we want to be doing, and I'm hoping that we can grow both in the podcast and the newsletter and continue to have fun. The podcast has really been a hoot. So,
oh yeah, you can tell. I mean, it really comes through when you're talking, whether it's your guests or you're just giving your thoughts on the topic du jour, recipe. So, yeah, and I will put the show notes or the link to that in my show notes as well. So, if folks want to check it out, if they haven't found it already, we'll get them over there. But I was hoping I could ask you a couple of food related questions, cooking related questions, if you don't mind.
I don't mind, and I'll tell you if I don't know the answers.
Okay. Well, these might be more philosophical than technical anyway. So one of the things I really admire about how you communicate your enthusiasm around vegetables, and you're just reading your posts and stuff, it's like spring onions are here, and it's just so joyful. And I feel that way about produce here in the Willamette Valley, but a lot of times it's around like the fruits, you know, the berries and the cherries and the pears and the apples, it's amazing here, but I don't quite rise to the level on the vegetable side of things. So I need some pointers now that summer is upon us and we have just this embarrassment of riches in vegetable produce. How can I get outside perhaps, maybe on my grill, and use vegetables more than I do meat? That's a very open-ended question, but I know you've given it a lot of thought.
Well, I have. I mean, it's funny because your lead up made me think about fruit, and fruit is really like in a world of its own, because when you have fruit in season, you know, it can be 2 weeks, it can be a month.
Yeah.
I mean, apples and pears are different, but berries, It's rare that it's more than a month. Peaches and stone fruit, it's really often a matter of weeks and not more than that. So that is so special. Whereas where you live, you know, collard greens and broccoli, you can probably grow 10 months a year. And right. here you can grow, where I live, you can grow them 8 months a year. They don't have that quality of rarity. Even if you're looking for, you know, even if you're selective and you say, I only want local root vegetables store for just about ever, we're still eating celeriac that we harvested in October, November. I mean, that's half a year of something just sitting around. So I think there is a way in which vegetables just aren't as special as fruit, but you know, they are the most important source of nutrients if you count legumes and whole grains and then vegetables. Those are the most important source of nutrients in the world. Legumes are the most important source of protein in the world, generally speaking. So it behooves us to like that stuff. Having said all of that, your question was, how do I grill more vegetables? And I think in some ways the answer may have to do with how you treat them before they get grilled. In other ways, it may be the grill temperature. So let me just say a couple things. One thing is that you can grill just about anything. But if you're grilling root vegetables, for example, carrots or potatoes or celeriac, which I just mentioned, the amount of time that it's going to take for them to soften is usually longer than the amount of time that it's going to take for them to become tough or maybe even burned on the outside. So with root vegetables, it's tricky to grill them directly. It's often easier to parboil them until they're kind of half done and then grill them after that. So that's kind of just a tip, I guess. But the other tip is that one of the things that gas grills do amazingly is grill vegetables. And you can load up a gas grill with 5 different kinds of vegetables, cut in half or sliced or sometimes even left whole. I mean, it depends on the size, and doused in olive oil, salt, and pepper, other seasonings if you want, of course, and then load that onto a gas grill on really low heat with the cover down and just kind of cook that the way you'd cook in an oven. I mean, you have to pay attention and you have to turn, but the odds of them burning and the odds of them undercooking are not bad. I mean, you really can cook eggplant and carrots and potatoes and broccoli and all kinds of stuff at the same time, as long as you use low heat and a kind of, or indirect heat and a covered grill. That's not, you know, live grilling, and there are people who are going to argue that that's not even real grilling, but it does have the benefit of cooking outside, right. And it does have the benefit of not heating up your kitchen, I'm not a snob about grilling. I think whatever works for you is fine with me. I mean, I build wood fires and I sometimes grill that way, but I also turn on gas grills and just, you know, go with the flow. So, anyway, so those are two kind of interesting vegetable thoughts.
And you know, you bring up a good point. You can grill almost anything. I remember a few years ago, I don't know where I read about it, but I had this epiphany that you can grill lettuce. So somebody shared a recipe for like a grilled Caesar salad where you just cut the romaine in half, keep it whole, and just lay it on the grill to get some char on. It was phenomenal.
Yeah, I did that a couple of weeks ago, actually, and it really is fun. You have to pay attention because, you know, turning those leaves into charred pieces of leather is always a possibility. But if you have a half a head of romaine with a little olive oil on it and you cook it for 2 or 3 minutes on a side, it's really a great thing.
Yeah, it switches up something very ordinary into something a little bit more special. And you mentioned celeriac, and I know, I think it was on the Nigella episode again, you talked about that a bit. Are there any unsung vegetables that you think need their time in the sun? I mean, I like cucumbers and green beans as much as the next guy, right? But I mean, I also eat my weight in them every summer. And I don't know if that's because they're familiar and I grew up eating them and I know how to work with them. You know, and I might, you know, I might walk by the kohlrabi or something like that in the produce department.
I mean, a good, you know, a good cucumber, there's nothing like it, but there's not a lot you can do with it. I mean, it's,
yeah, you can eat it.
You know, it's not that, you would not say the cucumber is the, you know, the king of versatility, right. Because they're kind of weird cooked. I think, you know, you mentioned kohlrabi, we mentioned celeriac. I think, I don't understand what happened with kale. I mean, obviously it's good for you, but it's not as, and I, my second book was called Leafy Greens. I was writing about kale and collards and so on back in the early 90s, even earlier. But I think if there were vegetables that are underserved or underpraised, it's root vegetables, which is kind of funny since the potato is obviously the most eaten vegetable in the United States. But then when you think about beets, kohlrabi, celeriac, and turnips and so on down that line, those to me are really unsung and really great. And I think, let's see, a couple things to say about those. One is that everything I just mentioned can be eaten raw, and people don't appreciate, many people don't appreciate that. So a beet salad, raw beet salad, is really terrific. And that's just, you know, grate some beets and dress it with, peel and grate some beets and then dress it with, you know, a good vinaigrette. Celery remoulade, which is grated celeriac mixed with a kind of sharp mayonnaise, is a classic and a fabulous dish. Turnips sliced really thin and just salted and snacked on, as good as carrots, really great. Kohlrabi, same thing. Raw kohlrabi is amazing. And then I think the other thing is different people like different varieties. And vegetables, you know, vegetables are kind of like fish, only more so, which is to say there are more kinds of these things than anyone can imagine. So you can say beets, and we all think of sort of these big red things that they sell in the supermarket, but there are dozens and dozens of varieties of beets, and some, and they taste different, and some people like some and some people like others. And maybe even a better example of that is turnips, where there are turnips with very, very strong flavors that I will say some or many people find unpleasant, but then there are white turnips and purple top turnips that when they're young, they're extremely mild, milder than radishes. And people are surprised when they'll be like, well, what's this? And you'd be like, it's a turnip. You know, you just never had a young, mild turnip before. So I know the world of vegetables, obviously there are people who eat nothing but, I'm not one of them, but it's a world that can be explored forever, and you're never going to, you know, especially if you're a gardener, but even if you're not, if you shop at a farmer's market or no farmers, no gardeners, you're just going to find different varieties and different, you know, everything is different depending on its age and so on. But, you know, the short answer is root vegetables are one of the ones that are under praised.
And one more, and then I'll let you get going. This idea, you know, I said a minute ago, I live in the Willamette Valley. Produce, access to produce is not a problem where I live pretty much any time of the year, certainly for fresh seasonal produce. And you just mentioned things like shopping at farmers markets. Any just general thoughts? I know that there's a lot of literature out there about things like food deserts or places where access to fresh vegetables aren't necessarily, you know, it's just not easy per se to get those things in hand. Any thoughts around that? On, I know I'm a big proponent of frozen vegetables. I think they're great, but just in general, any thoughts around that?
You know, well, good for you. Good for you on the frozen vegetable thing, because I've been beating that drum for a long time, and arguably, frozen vegetables are preferable to a lot of the so-called fresh vegetables that we see in supermarkets. So that's, you know, I don't think we need to go into that, But you know, if your broccoli is coming from 2,000 or 3,000 miles away in the middle of the winter, then I think you're better off checking out the frozen broccoli sometimes. So that's a good point. But I think in general, we have forsaken a regional food system. We've forsaken regional food supply, and it's to our detriment to the extent that we can grow and find food locally, not just vegetables, but everything else. We're better off, but we've created a food system where things are shipped hundreds and thousands of miles and they're grown in incredible quantities and under mostly miserable circumstances. So the opportunity for any of us, I mean, obviously it's easier for those of us who have money than for those of us who don't, but the opportunities for any of us to get really beautiful fresh produce at even in season are limited. It's not easy. You have to work at it. You have to be devoted to it. It's they don't show up in the supermarket like everything else, and they certainly don't show up in convenience stores.
Well, Mark, I appreciate your time coming on the show today, and I will make sure everybody gets to the links. But if there's a website address you want to share, where should people go to just connect with all your good stuff directly?
Thanks for everything, Roger. I guess the best one is markbittman.com, although bittmanproject.com works also. But the easiest to remember is markbittman.com. It's a one-stop shopping over there. So, yeah.
Okay. Fantastic.
Thanks again.
Well, thank you, Mark, and talk soon.
Okay. Take care.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much for tuning in this week to the Kitchen Counter Podcast. Thank you, Mark, for taking time out of your busy schedule to come and talk about food with Mark Bittman and the Bittman Project and all the other cool stuff you've got going on. If you want the show notes to this episode, head over to kitchencounterpodcast.com/188. Well, folks, I will be back next week for another episode of the Kitchen Counter Podcast. But, you know, until then, be sure to check out the Nitty Grits Podcast Network down at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. You can find that by going to southernfood.org and looking for Nitty Grits Podcast Network on their website. And check out some of the other great shows that are there. I think you'll find something that will interest you. And I know the network's growing all the time. Oh, yeah. Also, thanks to Tillamook Ice Cream for getting me through the heat wave, me and my family. Thank you very, very much. So until next time, I am Roger with the Kitchen Counter Podcast. Happy cooking.